This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Sharmila Ganesan, and welcome to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture. This is an 8-part mini-series that delves into key aspects of Malaysian history. Today, for our fourth episode, we will be exploring the history of women in 19th century Malaya. And I have with me via Skype Dr. Mulaika Hijaz, who is a lecturer in Southeast Asian Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. So let's maybe start off by setting the scene, Mulaika, and start with a historical overview of the Malay world in the early in the 19th and early 20th centuries, right? What were some of the main stereotypes or popular ideas about the lives and the status of women in this period that perhaps we should be challenging?
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting question, because I mean our big problem is sources, right? So it's quite hard to get a sense of it from really good data. You know, we'd really like there to be diaries and letters and that kind of thing, and we don't really have that. So what we have is, you know, Western accounts, which are obviously problematic, and then we have the sort of indigenous or Malay language or Japanese language or whatever literary accounts, which is kind of the stuff I work with. I think that the perception or the stereotype of women in the 19th century, early 20th century is of them being more oppressed, of society being more backwards, and then there's a kind of sense that we have a teleological, a development. The narrative is one of development, that we go from the Dark Ages into into a more enlightened and more liberated age. I mean, to some extent that's true, but there are other ways in which women of this period were not as oppressed as perhaps the knee-jerk stereotype is. So, for instance, I've done some work on women's literacy, and the stereotype of that is, okay, so there are presumably no literate women before colonial schooling, and that is actually just not true at all. Yeah, so the stereotype is that women in, you know, so-called traditional societies didn't know how to write and all of that. And you know, I see this repeated in, you know, all kinds of places, but actually isn't really based on evidence. I mean, of course, literacy as a whole for the population is much more restricted than it is in societies with, mass education systems. But actually, in Malay-speaking areas, it seems to have, or in island Southeast Asia in general, women seem to have been unusually high literacy rates. And so scholars have hypothesized that this might have to do with women's engagement in trade, which was pretty normal and widespread. So that's another sort of, I think, stereotype, is that, you know, women are at home and they don't, you know, but actually, you know, women were working, lots of women were working in various ways. There are all kinds of differences between what historians and other researchers have tried to uncover, and between a kind of, you know, like, oh yes, it was terribly backwards.
So you mentioned sort of the lack of sources, historical sources. What types of sources do we have that we can use to access the worlds of women in 19th century Malaya?
Well, we have some literary texts. So, my first big bit of research was on texts, narrative poems, Shire, that were written by women, and we have the names of the authors. And then in more cases, I think for women, you know, this sort of texts that we know were more appealing to women readers. And so we can get a sense. Of course, it's not you look at literary texts and it isn't actually a documentary description of women's lives. Rather, it's a description of the kinds of things they were interested in, of a kind of imaginary world, which tells you something about people's mentalities, about the things that were important to them, the things that were contested. It doesn't exactly tell you, of course, about, you know, women's lives. So in the same way as, like, if you, I don't know, watch Sex and the City, it's not actually a documentary, right? it's a fantasy. It tells you something, but not a one-to-one, you know, correlation.
Mm. So what does this then tell us about some of the societal roles that women played in this period and the kind of expectations that were held of them?
Yeah, so the texts that I mentioned, which were these narrative poems from this royal court of Penyengat, which is just south of Singapore. Mm-hmm. So they were coming from, a kind of court situation in which women were, they had agency, but it was restricted in a certain kind of way. It was also one where new ideas about Islamic, new ways of practicing Islam, which were more heavily influenced than previously by what was becoming the norm in the Western Islamic world, were, you know, really being implemented for the first time. So this is most famously through Raja Ali Haji, who is sort of the lead writer and scholar in this circle. And what we can see in the text is that, there's a bit of contestation around this issue. The text, that these poems are much more, Islamized in a way. So they're the same kinds of stories as older texts that we have, but those texts were set in a kind of magical Java, and you have gods appearing in human form and all that. So we don't get that anymore from these texts in Penyengat. We get the story is set in Damascus or somewhere like that. But the stories all feature a very heroic women who go to rescue their male relatives, in fact. So I think we can see that there is some sort of contestation about what the proper role of women is,
And as a contrast to these sources, what do the, I suppose, the colonial British and Dutch sources have to say about women from this region?
Oh, well, not much really, right? Because they're from the outside and they look the people with whom the colonial officials interacted were and there were some women. Mm-hmm. So if we look at, where I work, my university has a huge cache of letters from the 19th century. And these include letters from women traders to the British officials. So, I mean, there's some kind of interaction there. Mm. But, you know, by and large, the colonial kind of establishment doesn't really engage very much. It doesn't know very much. So it says some things. So you have travelers' accounts of, oh, here are these. I mean, it's sort of seen from a great distance. I mean, they're not that useful. Then I also teach on, European writing, mostly from the colonial period, about Southeast Asia. And, you know, all of these depictions say, this is not of Malaya, but Burmese days and things like that. I mean, they're not terribly valuable in historical terms. Mm. They tell you more about the colonial observer than they do about the woman subject. Yeah.
Mm. So getting back to the sources that you speak about in your book, Victorious Wives, you particularly focus on the importance of the sha'ir when it comes to thinking about the ways in which women were producers and consumers of literature. What is so special about the sha'ir in particular?
Well, there seems to have been like a huge boom in Shire production in the 19th century. It, you know, it's a form that existed earlier for a long time, but there's a huge number of texts that seem to proliferate around this time. It's the popular form, and there is some indication that this is also Also, shire can be about anything. Like, you can have a shire, but my favorite random shire is one called Shire Potongaji. So you can have shire about absolutely anything. But there were a huge number of these that had these very dynamic sort of female main characters. And so they seem to have appealed to women in particular. Why the shire and why not a prose narrative? It's difficult to say. We do know that shire, but prose narratives as well, you know, that they're not consumed in the way that we now say read novels. They're read in a kind of communal or a group context, and it's more like a recitation, and you could consume it, you know, by listening rather than by sight reading. So, yeah, a kind of domestic context, which maybe particularly suits female consumption at the time.
And you alluded to this earlier as well, about sort of the challenges of looking at these texts as strictly historical. But nevertheless, you know, what kind of light do they shed on the inner worlds of Malay women of that era?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's precisely it. They shed light on the inner world, not on the, not maybe exactly on the material world. So, which is very valuable in a way. I mean, you know, of course, we'd like to have lots of statistics about, I don't know, mortality rates or, you know, all that kind of stuff. But this is actually telling you something about the issues that interested them, the ways that it could be discussed. But I think it's also very important to, you know, Malay literature, traditional Malay literature has always, well, it has often been studied in order to get at something else. It's very infrequently studied for its as literature. And so the very eminent Malaysian scholar Kasim Ahmad wrote about this, you know, decades ago. Malay literature is studied to find out historical facts, to find out sociological things, but very rarely, even after all these years, is it studied as literature. And I think it is really important to foreground the fact that it is literature and it deserves to be read as such.
And do you think it matters that largely the study of that has been done by men, and therefore the readings are perhaps not, viewed through a fairly homogenous lens?
Yes. I mean, indeed, there is something about that. So my teachers and predecessors in this field, who are all men, right? So to their credit, they, you know, here and there, they'd be like, oh, yes, you know, there were women readers, but it wasn't something that particularly interested them. I mean, you know, well, the things they interested you are very personal. So they didn't spend very much time on that. So yes, I mean, you know, people, what research is done is very much determined by, you know, what people's idiosyncrasies. And there are not many people in this field at all of any, you know, of either sex, unfortunately. So yeah, it's a kind of strange, restricted situation.
So we do need to take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll take a closer look at the Shire and how women were not only authors of these texts, but also the protagonists, readers and listeners. So you're listening to History on Repeat. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Mulaika Hijaz, lecturer in Southeast Asian Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, about the history of women in 19th century Malaya. We'll be back after a short break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to History on Repeat, the 8-part mini-series where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and why they matter today. In this segment, I'm speaking via Skype with Dr. Mulaika Hijaz, who is a lecturer in Southeast Asian Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. And we're talking about the history of women in 19th century Malaya. So before the break, we spoke about the sources that are available for studying these women, as well as their shifting roles in society. Now now we'll dive deeper into those sources. So Malaika, you know, what I found really interesting about the way you talked about the Sha'ir in your book, Victorious Wives, was the fact that these women, they were the authors, but they were also the, they basically starred in the Sha'irs. They were the intended readers. They were also the listeners. Can you sort of describe this really complex interplay of roles for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to remember that it's different from book publishing now, right? Mm-hmm. So, it's a kind of, you write the book, you read it to your circle. Maybe they're also writing things, or you copy it. You know, there's no industrial production, there's no market. Mm-hmm. It's all, how do you get a book? You have to borrow it from somebody else and copy it. So it's all through these sort of personal connections. So it's not, I mean, at the end of the 19th century, we get lithographic printing in Singapore and a huge big boom in printing. So then we enter a kind of, print capitalism, as Benedict Anderson would say. I mean, suddenly it's a commodity. And then you get actually really interesting kind of explosion in numbers of texts. But at the time that most of these were composed, it's sort of, a very domestic, personal network of readers, of reciters, and so the producers and the consumers of the literature are all kind of quite close.
Mm. Were there particular tropes or themes that were common or sort of ran through a lot of these Sha'irs?
Yeah, so that book is based on six Sha'ir that all have these very similar themes. I mean, the main one being that there's a heroine who disguises herself as a man, and then she just rescues someone. So, and there were like loads of them, just variations on this theme in particular. Different, you can see people, you know, the text is sort of responding to each other as well. They're kind of reworking the same trope in slightly different ways. Because there are lots of other things out there. Another big subset of romantic Sha'ir, these Panji stories, so the more, as I mentioned, in the more kind of Javanese sort of mythological stuff, which actually I think had been the default fiction genre style for before this, and that these Sha'ir that I was looking at are a kind of attempt to remove some elements that started to be looked at as problematic, you know, these gods appearing and all of this, and then we put it in a more a reformed, Islamized context, but still the theme is the same, actually.
So what do we then know about, we've talked about the Sha'ir, we've talked about the fact that women were perhaps, more learned or literate than a lot of us assume to be. What does all this tell us about women's education in that period? Was there a sort of formalized structure? What kind of education did they have?
Yeah, so I mean, there's no formal structure that we know of. I mean, certainly, so all the, official schools of the colonial state, and especially education for girls, comes a whole lot later. I guess 1920s are the very earliest. So this is an education which is taking place through traditional structures, and they don't, well, we have a few accounts of this. So famously, in Abdullah Munshi's autobiography, he mentions the fact that his grandmother ran a school and that there are boys and girls in it, right? So this is kind of Quran school situation. And I think it's interesting that the one running the school is a woman, and, and there are girls at the school. So even though it may be that, so a kind of basic level of literacy sufficient to read the Quran and so on is being imparted in these kinds of schools, also probably just in domestic situations. So it's going on that way as far as we can tell.
Mm. And could women participate in, I suppose, could they participate publicly in literary activities? You know, could they perform recitations publicly? Could they own manuscripts? Could they produce them and share them publicly?
They owned and they produced manuscripts. Mm-hmm. I guess it depends what we mean by public. So we also have, lots of quite entertaining descriptions in the Hikayat of, big weddings, the royal events, ceremonies, and then people reading Hikayat and actually, you know, a lot of these times you can't, you have no indication whether the person reading the shikaya aloud is a man or a woman. So, and, you know, certainly in these big events, there are a lot of women present, and, you know, court ceremonial is a huge deal, and it requires a huge amount of input from everybody, and women are very present in all of that as well.
And you mentioned the importance of reading the Quran, and I am curious about the role that Islam, and particularly the emphasis on learning to read the Quran, how did that influence female literacy levels in the Malay world?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, so the scholars like Tony Reid have suggested that there was a baseline acceptance of female literacy before Islam. So we see quite surprisingly, we see indications of female literacy in places we maybe wouldn't expect it, like the Philippines and Highland Sumatra. So already there's maybe, I mean, the argument is that there's a kind of baseline acceptance of this. And then you get a new kind of a new script, a new religion. And then because there's a belief that, you know, you need a certain amount, everybody should have a certain amount at least, you know, you should be able to read a bit, that goes along with that. And but if we look, for instance, at what, I mean, admittedly not very good data from, say, you know, Cairo, for female literacy, it's incredibly low, right? So it's the Malay world rate seems to be an order of magnitude higher. So it's an adaptation of the new script, the new religion, the new to a pre-existing state, which both of which seem to, you know, support a certain level of female literacy. Yeah.
And what can we learn about sort of these informal correspondence networks that occur between women from, let's say, the letters that they're writing each other?
Yes, unfortunately, we don't have that many letters. Between, you know, I mean, this huge lack of that kind of material. You know, there are a few manuscripts that I know of where it says, so someone from the Penyengat court that says, you know, I borrowed this from Tunku so and so, and one of them is from, I don't know, Kelantan or somewhere. So they see that there are, and of course they were all, you know, intermarried, so they have relation, you know, they have family ties with different royal families. So that's the way it's kind of working. I mean, it would be amazing if we suddenly found a load of letters between women, but I haven't seen them yet.
It does strike me, though, that thus far we have sort of, or rather the questions that I've been asking has almost presupposed that the women that we're talking about are literate, right? The sort of the world that you talk about in Victorious Wives, it revolves around that courtly world, Riau, and so on. How do we access the worlds of non-literate women?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's incredibly difficult because, of course, you know, we're talking about a time that has passed, and what we have only the material that we have, and that's written material. Of course, there's oral literature, and that's a really important source, but we should also probably be fairly conservative about, you know, if you collect stories now or when people first started collecting them, maybe in the 40s, I mean, they are going to reflect that moment. I don't know how much further back you can push it. You know, it would be great to have, so the voices of the sort of common people, male or female, you're not really getting them in these texts at all, which is very regrettable, but it's a basic limitation of the sources.
What about, I suppose, material or visual sources, you know, things like clothing or portrait, jewelry, would they help us sort of uncover some of the history of women in this period?
I mean, they might. That's something that I think, it would be great if there were more work on that. Of course, again, it's a bit of a, you know, what are the things that have been preserved? Well, yeah, jewelry, the prestige objects of the wealthy people, right?
Yeah.
But even that, I mean, there's not a huge, there's a lot of textiles and things, but again, this is, these are not necessarily of the folk, you know, the sort of non-elite people.
Mm. Much of your work has focused on Malay women in the 19th century. Yeah. I'm curious about how these experiences compare with women of other ethnicities that were living in Malaya and the region and in the Malay world in this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, of course, it's always, you know, people read. I think one thing to say is that our conception of what Malay is now is not really the conception that they had even 50 or 100 years ago. And so when I say a Malay manuscript, I mean, it's in Malay. That's all I mean. I don't mean any implication about, you know, the actual ethnic background. And that's important because, so we know that people of Chinese ethnicity wrote a lot of sha'ir, and we have lots of these. So, you know, this was, so they wrote and they read them. And also, you know, actually the kind of ethnic composition of even somewhere like Penyengat, well, are they Malay? Are they Bugis? And the female population of the court, which would include a large number of slaves who would come from, you know, the eastern parts of what's now Indonesia or even from, you know, the Middle East, that you know, it's a very complicated or it's a very mixed ethnic situation. Most people would a lot of people would speak more than one language. I mean, as is common now, but you know, you only see the Malay, right? Because the text is in Malay. But actually, there you have to sort of keep in mind that there's a more heterogeneous situation actually behind it.
Mm. And this period was also characterized by a sort of rapid development of cities, right? Kuala Lumpur, Penang, Singapore. How did urbanization come to play in the way women lived?
In the way they lived? Well, you know, so this urbanization really is from, I guess, the 1910s onwards. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of where my, you know, so the manuscript tradition kind of dies at the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, then, and the really the big sort of seismic change in communities in the region is that modernity, urbanization, compulsory schooling, you know, all of that kind of stuff. It just turns everything kind of upside down. And I think that's, you know, an ongoing process as well.
Mm. And what do you see as being some of the most significant changes in women's lives as we move forward into the early 20th century?
Oh, that's a big, that's a huge question. Well, I think, you know, that it's sort of I'm going to have to think about that. You know, I think we have ongoing contestation about what women's roles should be, particularly in terms of Islamic requirements. And that is a kind of a painful process and ongoing.
Mm. I guess the simpler way to ask the question would be, as the 19th century sort of shifted into the early 20th century, what were some of the big changes that started happening, particularly for women?
Yeah, well, I guess you know, now there's a, so for those women of those courts, all the old, for particularly the Penyengat court, because it's abolished in 1913, they all moved to Singapore. Suddenly you're living in a very multi-ethnic, modern, you know, in there's a complete reinvention. And now you work, you know, you might be expected to get an education and work in different roles and, you know, all this stuff that never existed before, which, of course, in a lot of ways is an immense liberation, you know, a move forwards.
Well, the one thing that I did find interesting about your approach to talking about a lot of these changes in your book is the fact that you do problematize what this idea of modernity can mean. You talk about how while it might be tempting to sort of call a lot of these women in the 19th century feminist or proto-feminists, it's not as simple as that. Why do you say that?
Yeah, I mean, they're not feminists, right? They didn't have a conception of that. They certainly felt it when, for instance, their husband wanted to take a second wife. But that doesn't amount to a feminist analysis, I guess. So, for instance, in the Shire, which have these very active heroines and then these very strangely passive and kind of fairly useless husbands, in the end, actually, what happens is a kind of return to status quo, right? So they go back into, they stop dressing as a man and doing all these things, and then they go back into the palace and everything, and he has a second wife and everything is fine. And I mean, that's not a feminist ending, but they couldn't have had that. It's totally anachronistic. But what we can see is a kind of resistance to a certain patriarchal discourse and an attempt to work, imagine a way out of it, around it, and one that fails, right? Because in the end, I mean, the ending is always a return to some, an acceptance of the way things are. You know, there's no Thelma and Louise ending. I mean, that's not possible. So, you know, often I see there's a very common and very understandable thing where you sort of look for heroines in the past and try to make them into heroines, you know, for now. But they lived in a different time with different, you know, everything, all the assumptions were different. And I think looking for, it can't really quite translate like that.
We shouldn't impose our lens onto their lives, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, we've got enough to do to find out what we can about their lives and about their worldview. And it's a bit much to expect them to do something for us, you know.
Well, reflecting a little bit more broadly here, in a historical tradition that is often dominated by men, you know, both as authors and sort of the central characters, why is it so important to study the literary and historical worlds of women?
Yeah, just to try to look underneath to try to figure out what's going on, to try to figure out the reality maybe for half of the population. When we're talking about the Malay manuscript tradition, it's really important to remember that of course it varies from text to text, but like say a famous one, that's Sejarah Melayu, it's a particular, you know, it represents an elite aristocratic viewpoint. And, you know, everything follows from that. But even so, if you try to kind of unpick it a little bit, you may be able to recover something about other segments of the society.
So what more, in your opinion, can be done, needs to be done to continue writing the histories of these women?
Well, I think just, you know, there's, I mean, I say the limitation of sources, but there's also loads of texts out there that no one's read. And we don't even have a terribly good idea of what is in them. So there's just all kinds of primary work to do. I think to just keep working on this material and not in a way where we're trying to show how great it was or, you know, all these kinds of things, but really just to try to understand it on its own terms. And I think it will turn up all kinds of insights into the lives of women, but into lots of other aspects of the society of the past.
Thank you so much, Malaika.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to History on Repeat, the 8-part mini-series where we think through an arc of key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and discuss why they still matter today. Today, I've been speaking with Dr. Malaika Hijaz, lecturer in Southeast Asian Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies in the University of London, about the history of women in 19th century Malaya. If you've missed any part of this interview or any previous segments, you can download the podcasts on bfm.my. BFMI, on our BFM app, or on Spotify. You've been listening to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.